we're on the record. Time is 3:45. This is a Senate Resources Committee. Today's date is Thursday, January 28th, 2010. Apologize for the delay in getting started. We've had a series of power outages here in Juneau, and we have a number of committee members whose schedule's been shuffled around because of the power outages. Senator Huggins and Senator McGuire are excused, and Senator Stevens, I understand, is finishing up a meeting. Here with me is Senator French and Wilkowski, and we're here to get some information about the open season for Alaska gas pipeline projects. And we have Scott Hobbs and Mark Moronis. And please put yourself on the record and start with your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Scott Hobbs. I am a consultant for the AGEA team for the administration. And I'm here, as you've mentioned earlier, to speak with you about the open season process that we're about to embark on for the Alaskan Gas Pipeline Project. And I'd like to share with you my thoughts and give you a little bit of background. If you go to the next slide here, what I'd like to cover is a little bit of background and a progress assessment. How are we doing so far? Then I'm going to shift to a discussion of open seasons in general. Not this particular open season, but what happens with open seasons in the lower 48. Then we'll shift to the actual Alaskan Gas Pipeline Project open season and the open seasons we expect this year. And then I'll conclude with a few remarks in terms of my observations of what's taking place and what I expect to take place. With that, let me start with a bit of a disclaimer. I'm here as an advisor to the AGEA team. I'm going to give you opinions and things that I have observed in my 33 years in the business. So obviously things that I may put forth as my opinions would not necessarily represent what the AGEA team would believe. These are just my independent observations and opinions. A little bit about my background. I've spent the last 33 years in the natural gas business. I had the good fortune of being involved with the Coastal Corporation for almost 24 years. In that capacity, I helped manage their gas pipeline systems in the Rocky Mountain area and, to the lesser extent, their gas pipeline systems in the Midwest. I've mentioned to you my role as a consultant to the state. So with that, let's move on to the next slide. I thought I'd begin by speaking or giving you an independent third-party assessment of where we stand. How are we doing right now? This is a quote from the American Gas Association in their most recent energy analysis that actually came out this month. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just read it to you. Creating the pipeline transportation system to connect Alaskan supplies to the North American pipeline grid has been proposed for over 30 years. The concept seems to have more tangible momentum with key players moving closer to measurable progress. Many analysts believe that a pipeline connecting North Slope reserves to the lower 48 states is closer than ever, and that by 2020 or soon thereafter, as much as 4.5 BCF a day may be flowing. I would make a very similar assessment as the American Gas Association.
Can I ask you, I want to stop and ask you a couple questions on
sure.
this. We've heard from a variety of sources that the gas line is dead, AGEA is dead, this project will not happen because of the explosion of shale gas finds in the lower 48. This project will not happen because of the explosion of LNG imports to the lower 48. Do you share those assessments?
I do not. I think the facts, you know, obviously I have opinions, but let's let the facts speak. Look at where we are right now. We have the largest gas pipeline operator in North America and the three North Slope producers all working actively on a gas pipeline project, either in the form of Denali or in the form of the AGEA sponsored or the AGEA licensee. That says something. All of these parties are actively moving forward with this project. Obviously, the shale gas development in the lower 48 presents a competitive alternative for certain customers in the lower 48. But there also is very likely an increase in demand taking place there. LNG has not really markedly increased in terms of LNG imports into the U.S. What you're seeing has gone up somewhat. They may use big statistical increases in percentages, but the number is about 1 or 2 BCF a day. It's a small number. So I don't share those beliefs. I think the project has made great progress so far, and I think it's positioned to continue to progress.
Do you believe that Alaska natural gas from a pipeline being transmitted, is it 1,500, 1,600 miles away, can compete economically with shale gas?
Well, that remains to be seen. Obviously, what is the cost of development of shale gas? There are people that will tell you that it's a very expensive proposition. There are regulations that are being considered at the federal level on hydraulic fracturing that could affect the cost of that. But at the same time, there is an overall demand need. We're talking about 10 years out. So the overall demand needs for the U.S., I believe Alaska Gas, as does EIA, as does AGA, and a lot of other agencies, believe that Alaska Gas will play a part in that overall supply mix.
Do you have a rough figure on what shale gas costs versus what is it is expected that the Alaska natural gas shipped via the pipeline will cost? What I've heard is shale gas really isn't economical below $6-$7 per MCF. Have you heard similar numbers?
I will tell you, my experience in the industry, it depends on which shales you're talking about. It depends on what part of the shale gas play you're talking about. There are clearly going to be shale gas development that will require that kind of price. There may be others that will be more economic than that. It's going to depend on, are you in the Haynesville? Are you in the Marcellus? Are you in the Barnett? Are you in the Eagle Ford? There's a lot of different opportunities out there, and I can tell you there will probably be different cost structures. I think ultimately, if you look at the cost, the fact that you have a developed supply at Prudhoe and a developing supply at Point Thompson, you have gas that is available, and that after you add the transport costs, depending on what your forecast is, I think can compete with any sort of supply in the lower 48.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So that really summarizes, I've pretty much given you my assessment of the progress we've made, but as I think the top of the slide says, we still have a ways to go. This is a project that still has challenges that it needs to meet. So let's move to what is an open season and why is it held? Well, an open season is a public process in which the project sponsors propose terms and specific design parameters to potential customers in the effort of soliciting bids for the capacity that they're proposing to build. It basically started as a requirement of the FERC. This actually comes out of what happened in the late 1980s in the open access era of gas pipelines. But this particular project has very specific requirements. Order 2005 says you will meet these requirements if you're going to have an open season for an Alaskan gas pipeline project. So they're very specific requirements that are laid out there. The purpose is really to ensure that all interested parties, it's a public process, can bid on that capacity. No one is shut out. Everyone will have an equal opportunity. And then essentially the pipeline sponsors will select those bids that place the highest value on that capacity.
Mr. Chairman, just a general question if I could. Thank you. About open seasons, do oil pipelines go through the open season process, or is this unique to gas pipelines?
It's generally unique to gas pipelines. They go through similar sorts of solicitations, but the actual formal process that you see in the gas pipeline industry has developed over time as somewhat unique to the gas process.
And that's my understanding, and maybe you could just explain to me and to the folks watching the hearing why that is. Why are oil pipelines different than gas pipelines as far as this kind of unusual open season process?
Well, through the chair, an oil pipeline is a common carrier. A gas pipeline is a contract carrier. So you actually end up contracting for capacity that you own and you control in a gas pipeline. With an oil pipeline, if someone new comes in and wants to move volumes through that oil pipeline, what will typically happen, and I'm not an oil pipeline expert, but will typically happen is they will be prorated. Those parties will be brought in and everyone else is reduced somewhat to accommodate those flows. So in that context, it's a common carrier where a gas pipeline is a contract carrier. So once you own that capacity, no one can come in and prorate you down to get capacity. You have to bid for new capacity on a gas pipeline, and you go through a new open season process where other parties are allowed to come in, and the pipeline looks at those bids and says, okay, I can construct new capacity to accommodate your request.
For expansions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
The next slide is basically talks about who will be involved in the open season process and this whole negotiation process that we're going to spend some time on. Well, obviously, the project sponsors. That would be the pipeline company that's proposing an open season. They're potential shippers. In a typical open season in the lower 48, those shippers might be a producer, it might be a marketing company, it might be a local distribution company that wants to procure gas for its customers. So those are the primary shippers that you'd find in a lower 48 type of open season. If you flip over to the other side, they're project regulators. In this case, that would be the FERC, the NEB, or through the NPA, the Northern Pipeline Act, the NEB in Canada, and the state actually has some say-so here as the AGIA licensor. So it has a certain regulatory authority here and oversight authority. Then there are other parties that may decide to get involved in an open season process. Those could be landowners, it could be competitors. It's really unusual for parties like that to jump into an open season or intervene with the commission to say, but as we'll talk about in a few moments, this particular open season for the Alaskan project has to file, they will actually have to file with the commission all of their procedures, 21 different items that they have to address. And that provides an avenue for other parties to intervene. So that's really what I was trying to get at there, is you may see some other parties jump into this process that will begin here rather shortly.
We stop and welcome Senator Stevens to the meeting. And let me just ask you, what other parties might we expect to see in this process?
It's a good question. Maybe no one. The state, as a royalty owner, needs to protect its interest. It may decide that there are provisions in the open season filing that's being put forth before the commission that they feel they need to comment on. Perhaps not. But it really depends on whether this avenue is the right place to do it. But all I'm suggesting is there may be more than just the traditional regulators and shippers that participate in this open season process. Okay, what takes place in this whole negotiation process that I'm alluding to? Well, in a typical open season, a pipeline sponsor will identify a project. Often they'll announce it in a press release. We're looking at moving gas from point A to point B. And then they'll begin initial discussions with potential customers or shippers. They'll generally come up with a package of terms, very rough, and say, we're looking at doing this, what do you think? And then the negotiation process begins. Each time you see an arrow here on this slide, there's generally negotiations going on, and there's project development work. They're starting to define the project, scope it, understand what kind of volumes or pipe, or where would it be directed to, what's the route. So that takes place, and then once they get that feedback, they begin a formal open season. That would typically take place where they actually go out with a formal announcement and say, okay, now to all comers, anyone that's interested in this capacity, here is a draft precedent agreement. Here are the terms and conditions that we want to go forward with this project on. Now, please make bids. Give us your bids in terms of what sort of capacity and what terms you are looking for if you're looking to alter the terms that we're offering.
Let me just take a minute and welcome Senator Stedman to the committee. Let me just stop you right there. So the bids for capacity, this would only be the producers coming forward. You would not expect to get someone who, let's say China, they had expressed an interest in purchasing 6 BCF of gas. They wouldn't come forward and say, we'll agree to buy gas. This is only producers bidding their gas. Is that correct?
For the Alaskan gas, I'm really trying to stay on a general project, but to answer your question, you're probably correct. It's unlikely that we will have other parties, but that's not to say that someone might not come in, be it a marketer, be it an LDC, or a third party like, we had the Chinese interested in this at one point. It's unlikely, but I can't say that that would not happen.
And just the TC is going to be making a filing tomorrow. And is that, are we at box two, then the open season package?
We are at box two. What you will see filed tomorrow, at least my understanding of what you will see, is the full open season package that will be compliant with FERC Order 2005. Okay, once the open season begins, again, you see another little blue arrow, more negotiations. The package is put out there. I suspect that there will be a lot of give and take and discussion between potential shippers and, in this case, the project sponsors. Once the open season process is completed, then the bids for capacity are submitted. Generally, a draft precedent agreement is included in that package. The project sponsors would ask the parties who would like to participate to submit that agreement. More often than not, that agreement is submitted with changes and things that the shipper says, this is what I want. I understand your preceding agreement, but I want these conditions, I want these terms, and we'll go into that a great deal more here in a couple of slides. Once those bids are made and those conditions and terms are proposed, more negotiations. This can take some time. And then hopefully the outcrop of those negotiations is a precedent agreement. Now, it's very important. A lot of people have believed that a precedent agreement is when you get to the goal line. That's not really true. A precedent agreement has a lot of conditions in it and a lot of things that have to be accomplished before you ultimately achieve a firm transportation service agreement. That is the real goal line for a project sponsor. That's when you have a firm commitment and those conditions are removed. And this next slide gives you a little more background on that. So what's in that precedent agreement? Well, it's going to lay out the project scope, the services that are going to be provided. It's going to provide the key commercial terms and conditions that the pipeline sponsors are looking for. It lays out obligations on both the part of the shipper and the pipeline sponsor. There are obviously reps and warranties. There are conditions precedent. It's very common for a pipeline sponsor or a project sponsor to say, I will go forward if these conditions are achieved. Give you an example, an acceptable certificate from the FERC. If the FERC or their NEB comes in and says, wait a minute, we're going to change all of this, the pipeline reserves the right to walk away from the project. That's very typical in a precedent agreement. There are going to be creditworthiness standards, and there are going to be termination rights for both parties. That's very typical in a precedent agreement. To transform that into a firm transportation agreement, most of those commercial terms are going to be carried forward. A lot of the terms and conditions we just spoke about are carried forward. So you basically now have final commercial terms and conditions. And most importantly, those conditions precedent are removed. They're resolved. So now we really do have a firm commitment.
Can I just ask you a question on the preceding agreement? Is it one of the things that has been speculated is that a lot of the bids, or maybe all the bids, will be precedent upon fiscal certainty, let's say. Is that common? Do you expect that in this case?
If I could ask you to defer that question, I'm going to get into that in great detail in just a few slides. With the next slide, I'm just going to touch on what I, in my opinion, the typical outcomes for an open season. What can we expect at the end of this open season? Well, in some cases, there may be, and this has happened, minimal interest, no meaningful commitments. Well, in that case, for the pipelines or project sponsor, it's back to the drawing board. They may decide to defer the project, they may abandon the project. This has happened, but most savvy pipeline operators are not going to go out with an open season if they don't think they're going to get some kind of meaningful feedback or commitments from their shippers. You move to the second case, shipper interest, but maybe insufficient commitments. Perhaps we're looking at a pipeline project for 1 BCF a day, but we only get 700 million. Well, they go back to the and negotiate. Maybe there's some terms that they can change to get that last 300, so there's more negotiation. This is fairly common that you get this sort of outcome.
that, and you actually go, maybe go back and revise the scope, change the size of the pipe, reduce compression. There are a number of options that might be available to the parties. The third option or potential outcome is there are sufficient commitments. We get what we're looking for, say volumetrically, but there are a lot of conditions. This is a very highly probable outcome for most open seasons. You get what you're looking for, but well, they've got these two or three conditions that you got to work out. Maybe it's six or eight. I will tell you, based on my experience, this is highly, this happens a lot, is what I'm trying to say. In that case, well, you continue those negotiations and then try to establish what are mutually agreeable conditions between the parties. Finally, and this has happened as well, and I can say I've had the good fortune of this happening because a lot of legwork was done ahead of time, you get commitments that pretty much commit to exactly what you're looking for. The standard conditions are included. There's still going to be conditions precedent, but this is a highly unusual case as well. Unless it's a very clean, clear project with very little complexity or conditional type of risk that have to be dealt with, obviously in that case, you march forward with the project. The likely outcome for any real commercial project, that usually comes in between number two and number three. Obviously, the pipe pushes for four. This will give you an example timeline for a project in the lower 48. I picked an actual 5-year time frame, but I can tell you that the typical project in the lower 48 takes between 3 and 5 years. A lot of this can be compressed if the pipeline sponsor is willing to spend a lot of money on the front end to remove some of the time takers, some of the things that require a good deal of time, whether it's environmental work, whether it's field work, or issues that to get the FERC certificate filed early. I won't take a lot of time to go through this, but you can see that the steps that we just talked about are laid out here. The sponsors identify a project, put a package together, and then whoops, there's 6 months of discussions between sponsors and shippers to try to get those terms worked out before they initiate a formal open season. That is exactly what's going on right now with Denali and with the geo-sponsored project. Both of those projects are in the negotiation phase to try to work through terms before they roll out their open season packages. Next, you actually kick off the open season. I will tell you that a typical open season in the lower 48 is generally about 30 days or less. That's fairly common. I will say in this case, we have a 90-day requirement by virtue of FERC Order 2005. Once the bids are made, as if we fall on those middle two cases that I mentioned before, you're back to negotiations. That can take another 6 months to try to resolve those conditions and get firm precedent agreements. Once that's done, then you can move to the work necessary to get a FERC certificate filed. You notice that large blue block all through this process. There's a tremendous amount of engineering, environmental, right-of-way work to define the project, define the costs, in essence, do the pipeline engineering and design work necessary to advance the project. Assuming you receive a certificate over about, let's say, a 12-month period, then you would look to the project sanction decision. That's really where, for lack of a better term, the rubber meets the road. That's when the pipeline sponsors are ready to commit to the project. Which brings us to the next slide. When do you know that a project is really going to be constructed? That's really at the project sanction point. That's when the sponsors commit to construction, to construct the project. A lot of people might think it might be right after the precedent agreements, but there are way too many things that have to be addressed before any rational business person would commit to a project. And I've laid out a lot of that work here. You can see front-end engineering and design work, the environmental studies, regulatory and permit approvals. You want to see those certificate approvals from the NEB in this case and the FERC. You want to know that all the critical right-of-way has been acquired. You want to have detailed cost estimates so you've got a pretty good idea of what this thing is going to cost. And most importantly, all of the conditions preceding that were plugged into those preceding agreements are resolved. Once that's done, then firm transportation service agreements are executed, and obviously you need to make sure you've got the project financing necessary before you actually push the button and go forward and say, okay, we've sanctioned the project and we're ready to move forward. On January 12th, the FERC came to Anchorage and actually conducted a workshop on the upcoming open seasons for Alaska. And I think they did a very good job of walking through. Rich Foley did a presentation for the folks that attended that workshop. He did a very good job of detailing all of the requirements of FERC Order 2005. There are actually 21 separate things that have to be addressed. He cited the Ruby Pipeline project as a good example, if you want to look at a third-party project, to give you an example of what might be the general steps in a project. If you actually use a web search and want to look at Ruby Pipeline, you can go to their website, you can see their precedent agreements, you can see their schedule, you can see everything they've done. I should point out that he also went into some detail to talk about the conditions precedent. He called them ifs. If this happens, then I'll do this. And also the commitments that are contained in a typical precedent agreement. So a good discussion and a good, let's say, general agreement with our assessment of what to expect in a project like this. Okay, let's shift to the Alaskan Gas Pipeline. I think this next graphic gives you an idea of at least of my perception of the project. It's really a pipeline project just like any other. There are just a few more pieces that have to come together to make this work. What are those pieces? Well, here are some of the items that I think that somewhat distinguish this project from a typical project. Probably the most important is the project timeline. This project will probably take a minimum of 10 years. That's when you add that type of time frame to a project, you're injecting uncertainty, risk, particularly with respect to cost of the pipe, cost of the project, construction. Those are things that add to what it takes to get the project done and obviously make a good decision about whether to go forward with the project. The development cost and the total project cost. This project will cost over $30 billion. I think that's fairly likely. And it will have corresponding development costs that go along with that $30 billion. No other project in the lower 48 has even exceeded $7 billion. At a meeting a year or so ago, the folks at Goldman Sachs made a comment that I thought was fairly telling. They said, if you look at the AFUDC, and that's a buzzword in the pipeline business, allowance for funds used during construction. So that's the cost of money when you're building this, and if you spent $1 billion in year one, you get to accrue the cost of money on that, and that's part of your overall construction costs. If you look at the AFUDC for this project, it exceeds the cost of any other pipeline project that's been attempted in the lower 48.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I probably knew the answer to this not last summer, but the summer before when we spent all summer working on this project and this idea. But remind me whether remind me where we stand with respect to our throughput. Yes, our construction costs are far greater, but are there pipelines that deliver 4.5 BCF a day of gas in the lower 48?
Through the chair, there are pipelines that deliver that volume, but they've been built over years and years. There have been multiple expansions, additional loops. I don't believe any other project has attempted to take on that sort of initial volume. I don't believe there is any project that's approached that.
That debuted with 4.5 with the opportunity to go up.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman, another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you expand a little bit on your last comment about the kind of a carrying cost, what have you, of the cost of money over the 10-year period, and is it built into the tariff, or what kind of actual impact would that have?
Through the chair, it's considered a capital cost. It's typical for any pipeline project to accrue the cost of money on the invested funds through the project. It's allowed by the FERC and has been for years and years. It's called AFUDC, and it's something that it's just another cost, just like you would incur cost to put the pipe in the ground, to buy the pipe. When you have to order the pipe and you spend money, those monies, while you're in the construction phase or the development phase of the project, are allowed to be capitalized and included in the rate base and ultimately charged. Any project sponsor will include those costs in their, in what they actually put forth as rate base.
Thanks.
I follow up on that question. Is the tariff based on the present value of that money? In other words, if you spend $500 million in year one versus $500 million in year 10, does the FERC just consider that that's $500 million, or do they take the time value of that $500 million over the 10 years?
That's where the AFUDC comes into play. If you spend $500 million in year one, the rates are actually based on the accumulated cost in year 10. So that $500 million with a cost of money applied to it might be $700 million by the time you get to year 10. And that's what goes into the rates. The next item that I would point out to you in terms of understanding the complexity of this project, the gas quality and treatment of this gas. We will have to construct one of the largest, if not the largest, gas treatment plant that's ever been embarked on in the world to process this gas. So this is not a small undertaking. This is a very significant undertaking, particularly when you consider that you have to build it on the North Slope. So this is another distinguishing factor. The construction and logistical requirements on this, over 1,700 miles, Arctic and subarctic terrain, mountain ranges, earthquake zones, these are not insurmountable problems. I don't want to tell you that this is all something that makes this just so daunting we can't do it. This is very doable, but it's a challenge. The regulatory requirements and oversight, they're at least, we're dealing in two countries. There are multiple regulatory agencies. There are obviously Aboriginal peoples that are going to be dealing with this and having some say-so over it. So I will tell you that no other project has had to deal with this level of regulatory complexity or right-of-way complexity. But very doable. What will likely be negotiated as part of this open season process? Well, the obvious focus is the precedent agreement. That's what every project sponsor is trying to achieve, is a mutually agreeable precedent agreement. One of the interesting challenges that we'll face here is, I will tell you my experience in the lower 48, is generally because you're on a short time frame, the pipeline sponsor will say, I will build this project and I'm going to charge you 38 cents or $1.40. Because I've looked at the numbers, I'm going to have it in service in 3 years, and I want you to commit to pay $1.38 for this service. Here, because of the time frame and the uncertainty associated with the cost, rather than agree on a number, a rate, they will have to agree on rate principles. What is your return on equity? What is your capital structure? What are the components of the cost of service that will ultimately yield the rate once we get the project cost established? That's very different than from a typical open season. And that presents some additional challenges, but nothing that can't be addressed. But that, it means the parties, rather than saying, I'm not sure what you're going to earn on this, but I'm going to pay you $1.38, they're now saying, I want your return on equity to be limited to X. I want your capital structure to be Y. So that will be something that the parties will have to negotiate in this precedent agreement. I would suggest that because this is a non-operating pipeline, they're going to try to adopt probably an existing tariff. But the tariff, what I mean by tariff is that's all the terms and conditions that establish what a pipeline company has to do when they operate a pipeline. It may be hundreds of pages long. They will have to adopt probably... They will typically adopt an existing tariff that they're comfortable with, the pipeline sponsor. The shippers may come in and say, well, we want you to modify this. We want you to we don't like these particular terms. Hopefully that gets negotiated out during the open season process, but it's possible that there will be conditions in their bids that say, I want the force majeure provisions or the allocation of risk on demand charge or reservation charges to be such, you know, to reflect this versus what you've proposed. So I would expect that there may be proposed tariff modifications. The next item is something that you've heard from some of the potential shippers in their testimony in the past, equity participation. I think all of the major shippers or the major producers up on the North Slope have said they are very interested in owning a piece of the pipeline. I would suggest to you that that will probably be one of the terms that will be negotiated between the parties on these preceding agreements. Probably not a surprise to you. And obviously, they may also want to actually participate in the project management. They may want to suggest that if we're going to ship on this pipeline, we want to be part of the project management. We want to be responsible or have a say-so in how you're going to manage this project going forward. To speak to your question, Senator Wilkowski, earlier, what sort of conditions do we think are going to be included in these negotiated preceding agreements? Well, this is my assessment based on my experience, but these are the types of things that you would see in a typical agreement, but also based on my experience with this particular project, what I think you will likely see or possibly see for this specific project. As we've said before, there may be key commercial terms or tariff provisions that they haven't worked out between them. So they will say, okay, we will sign this preceding agreement subject to these terms being changed in this fashion. They may say, if there are adverse changes to my economics as a shipper, I want the right to get out of this agreement. Now, that can take a lot of different it can be incorporated in a lot of different ways. They may establish a walk-away right at a time certain down the road. They may say, if project costs exceed this, I want the right to walk away. They may say, if gas prices do this, I want the right to walk away. These are all things that will have to be negotiated between the parties. But generally, a shipper will say, if there's something that's adverse to my bottom line interest that I just can't commit, I want the right to walk down the road if this doesn't happen before project sanction. They may condition their bids on project milestones or deadlines not being achieved. If you don't file a certificate by a certain date, I want the right to walk away. If you don't achieve certain things that are maybe a condition that we both need to have addressed, I want the right to walk away. If the AOCC doesn't approve the offtake of the gas. There could be a number of issues that they want to specifically incorporate that if a regulatory agency doesn't do a certain thing, we want the ability to walk away. That could be a FERC certificate. It could be any regulatory authority that may have a significant impact on this project. Those are fairly typical in any sort of precedent agreement. To speak to your earlier question directly, they may condition their bids on acceptable fiscal terms, reaching acceptable fiscal terms with the state. That's certainly a possibility. They may condition their participation on a minimum level of equity participation in the project. That's a possibility. Obviously, they're going to condition this on certain board approvals. That's a standard in any agreement, any preceding agreement. But generally, that's limited to a certain time period. The pipeline will say, you've got to get your board approval by X date, so we know you're committed to the project. And finally, the termination rights that we've talked about here, that's very important to understand what's the basis for the termination, who's exercising, what's the consequences. If this project dies because a shipper pulls out, who pays for those costs that have been incurred up to that point? That's where things get a little dicey. That's where things have to get negotiated out between the parties. What does the pipeline pay for? What do the shippers pay for? What happens to the state's reimbursements for this project? All of those are things that are going to have to be resolved. I would suggest that the state will probably have a say-so in that process as well.
Senator French.
Chairman, thank you. Mr. Hobbs, dealing with fiscal terms, in your experience in this field, have you seen fiscal terms negotiated in open season commitments?
Through the chair, Senator French, I will tell you that fiscal terms in the lower 48 are generally not an issue that's been raised because in the lower 48, the general tax regimes are such that it's not really comparable to what the state of Alaska is really more like, because the resources here are so vast, you really can't compare the state of Alaska to the state of Texas. Maybe you could in 1910, but you can't right now. It's just not a fair comparison. A better comparison would be a foreign country where there's a known huge resource and you're comparing those fiscal regimes to what the state of Alaska is doing. In my opinion, that's a better comparison.
And just as a follow-up, what role, I mean, we have a rather subsurface, the inability for the state to alienate its rights to subsurface minerals is not entirely common. Many other states allow you to do that. Does that play a role at all in the setting of fiscal terms, or am I off base?
In my experience, I have not seen it through the chair. I apologize. I have not seen it come into play. There are severed mineral rights versus landowner. That's fairly common in the lower 48, but...
Right, in Texas, just for folks that are watching, in Texas, you can sell your mineral rights, right? You keep the surface rights, but someone else owns the oil underneath your land.
Through the chair, that is absolutely correct.
And that can't happen in Alaska. We, at least on state land, we keep those mineral rights, period, no matter what. They're always the state's.
To be honest, I didn't know that, but that's... I don't know if that will be... I have not seen that be an issue in the lower 48. So I guess to finish, these termination rights and the resulting impact of those termination rights, that's going to be a very important term that's going to have to be addressed and resolved in these precedent agreements.
Let me ask you a question on the fiscal term or any of these. One of the, and I don't know if you can answer this question or not, but one of the terms that we had in AGEA said that it, companies that bid their gas in initial open season get preferred rate. They have they get locked in at that rate for 10 years. If a company makes a bid in open season but conditions it on acceptable fiscal terms with the state, do you have an opinion about whether or not they qualify for that AGEA benefit?
I think that's going to require a legal reading of the statute. And obviously, you'll have to look at what the specific commitment says. And to be perfectly honest, I'd be speculating. I don't feel comfortable in speculating on that without knowing exactly what they bid, and what, as opposed to what the statute requires. It really is more of a legal question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, with all of these conditions that I think that might be added to the preceding agreement, what's the value of this? What are we getting out of this? Well, I think you're actually getting a lot. You need to go through this open season process to get these commitments to start defining how we're going to go forward. If we're going to design a pipeline, and when I say we, I'm talking about the pipeline sponsors, they need the technical information contained in those bids. They need to know the volume. They need to know the term. They need to know the maximum and minimum operating pressures. One of the requirements that at least the AGEA sanctioned project will have to meet is they need to provide an option to go to Valdez, and they need to provide an option to go to Alberta. The shippers need to commit where that gas will go. Do they want the gas to go to Valdez? Do they want an LNG option? Or do they want to go to Alberta? That's very important to establish that route and allow all comers to make those kinds of commitments so that we know how to go forward with the project. So receipt and delivery points, even though it sounds rather benign, that's very important, particularly for this project. It will provide the commercial terms and conditions that we need for shipper commitments. If you're going to go forward, you need to know, you need to frame the negotiations, the discussions. What is it that a particular shipper wants to commit to a project? This provides that process. They may have a load of conditions and they may have a load of changes to the terms, but you at least now know what they're looking for. That's progress. It will define the allocation or risk sharing for how you move the project forward, these termination rights. It will lay out, okay, I'm interested in committing to this project, but I want the right to get out at these certain terms, and I'll only pay these costs. Again, it's an allocation of the risk in terms of how to advance the project. So under any scenario, I think the project sponsor's understanding of the project and commercial requirements will be substantially improved by going through this open season process. The timeline for this is actually my understanding, and I must say that I am not here to represent the AGIA licensee or Denali, but this particular timeline is my understanding of what you may see for the AGIA licensee's proposed open season. It's my understanding that there will probably be a filing tomorrow with the FERC. If this thing goes according to the FERC 2005, the FERC will actually have, there will be 30 days for comments. That's a guess. The FERC actually establishes that. And then they'll have 30 days to act on it. So it basically gives the FERC 60 days to act on the filing by TransCanada. These dates may move around. I can't commit that this is what's going to happen, but it's illustrative as to what you may expect. Once the commission reacts and issues an order on that filing for the open season, we've plugged in 30 days for TransCanada to actually put together and formally initiate the open season. So that would begin somewhere around the end of April of this year. There'll be a 90-day period for the open season. That's a requirement under Order 2005. And at the end of that time period, you will actually see the bids submitted, hopefully draft precedent agreements with the changes made by the parties that are participating in the open season. I've plugged in 6 months here, five months, for negotiations to take place after those. There's nothing magic about that. That's my guess on what it might take to resolve the conditions and issues. It could take a lot longer than that, but obviously there has to be some sort of a target. So by the end of the year, hopefully you would have signed precedent agreements. At that point, the work that I talked about before, the front-end engineering and design, the environmental work, there's a tremendous amount of work that has to continue based on what you've learned from those preceding agreements to put together a certificate filing. We've plugged in a certificate filing that would actually be made with the FERC around the end of October 2012. If that's the case, we've plugged in about an 18-month, actually a slightly more than 18-month period for the commission to act on that certificate filing. Hopefully you would receive the certificate filing, an acceptable certificate of filing, at the end of June 2014, and we've provided an additional 4 months for the parties to review that filing, convert the precedent agreements into firm transportation agreements, and actually make a project sanction decision there at the end of October. Again, this is illustrative, but somewhat indicative of what a fairly reasonable time schedule would be for the TC Alaska project. Given all of this, what conclusions do I reach? Well, I think the project has made significant progress. But like any progress, any project at this stage, it faces future risks and uncertainties. There are going to be numerous issues that are going to have to be negotiated throughout this development phase, all the way up to project sanction. The successful completion of preceding agreements will not necessarily ensure that this project will go forward. That's not a guarantee. That won't take place until the project sanction date, which we're estimating probably late 2014. At that point, you'll be able to determine if the project's going to move forward and actually be constructed. That's not peculiar to this project. That obviously that date is, but it's fairly common to go all the way up to that project sanction point in any project before you know that you're actually really going to move forward, buy pipe, turn dirt, build the thing. The state may need to participate in negotiations with all of the parties to complete precedent agreements, but I think it's very likely that it will have to engage in negotiations to reach project sanction. I think the upcoming open season process will probably result, I said highly likely will result, in conditioned bids. But I think that will frame the issues for what needs to be negotiated to get binding precedent agreements to advance the project forward. Actually, the precedent agreements will probably be binding, but they'll be subject to a lot of conditions. So in that context, there will probably be binding precedent agreements submitted, but obviously subject to a lot of things that have to be worked out. Under any scenario, I think the project sponsors are going to be a lot better informed and better equipped to move the project forward through the certificate process, regardless of the outcome of the open season. A lot of very good information will be gained, and I think they can continue, at least in the case of the AGEA licensee, they will be able to fulfill their obligations to take this project through certificate. That concludes my presentation. Any other questions I could answer?
No, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Let me ask you this question. If there's a condition precedent, a company makes a contingent bid, let's say it's based on the company getting fiscal certainty or an acceptable fiscal tax structure, who's the judge of what is acceptable? In other words, let's say that the state then adjusts its tax structure, and I mean, who's the judge of whether or not this is acceptable? Is it solely up to the company, or would it go to court? How does that work?
It's an excellent question. I would suggest that both the state and the party are going to have to agree, and that if fiscal certainty is provided, I would think that fiscal certainty is provided on the condition that an absolute commitment is made to the project, so that there's not a second guess or a second chance to somehow change that. I would think the state would structure any sort of change to its fiscal regime to be contingent upon that party moving forward and making a firm transportation commitment.
Just as a follow-up, Senator Wilikowski makes a good point, and I guess it just may be worth stating that, you know, if the condition is fiscal certainty and that's all the direction we're given, that's going to be pretty tough to hammer out for us to decide what to do. But my assumption is that the request will be fairly black and white. We need 30 years of certainty on this commodity starting from this date in this form. Because we've granted fiscal certainty by statute, my understanding is that the industry doesn't highly value that promise. I do, but that's something we're going to confront during the open season, the opening of the bids. Does that make sense?
Through the chair, yes, it does make sense. But I think and I can't speak for the commissioners. It's entirely within their purview as far as what they want to do, and obviously the legislature and the governor. But I would suggest that any negotiation or request for fiscal certainty be spelled out in very specific terms, just as you've suggested, and that the administration would agree to that and then obviously present that to the legislature for their approval or whatever the requisite approvals are.
And what about, when does the negotiation stop? Say, for example, we're told we've got to have 30 years of fiscal certainty that's what our bid's contingent on. And let's just say the legislature meets, special session, and the best we can come up with is 25 years, that we do our own independent analysis and we just decide that 25 is the max. Are you still in the negotiating phase? I mean, does that put an end to the discussion, or is there still an opportunity for the parties to go back and modify their initial condition?
Through the chair, I would think there's always an opportunity for the parties to continue to negotiate. A lot will depend on what is negotiated between the shippers, the pipeline sponsors, and the representatives of the state that are participating in that negotiation. How that's actually laid out and structured will be up to those parties. I would guess that if the parties do what I would expect them to do, that represent the state, they're going to lay that out in a form that will be subject to the legislative approval. And obviously, if that doesn't occur, it's back to the drawing board.
And last, if I could, thanks, Mr. Chairman. And any external deadline on that? Is there some chance that we'll sort of run out of time to negotiate this, or are we working with deadlines and landmarks that are fluid?
Through the chair.
Within reason.
Everything is negotiable, I've been told.
Right.
But it may be that they will reach a point, they being the shippers, that they say if we can't achieve this by a certain date, they want to terminate their commitments.
We'll just have to see what's in the bids.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just so tomorrow the package comes out, we assume, from TransCanada, and there'll be, now is there there's an opportunity for public comment? Is that's 90 days?
No, that's to be determined. They will file it with the commission. The commission will notice the filing, and then they will stipulate how many days you have. It may be 21 days, it may be 30 days. I'm speculating, but I'm guessing it won't be more than 30 days for parties to comment, because I think, and I may be mistaken here, I think they have a 60-day window that they have to act on it. They're going to want to leave themselves some time to deliberate, so they're going to pick a time frame that allows the parties enough time to make comments, but then give them time to deliberate. They've also, they have the right, if I'm not mistaken, to actually extend that whole process. So it's possible that it may actually go beyond 60 days. But at least based on my experience, I would guess that they'll probably set 21 or 30 days as the public comment period. They'll take it under advisement, start deliberating on it, and then issue an order hopefully at the end of 60 days.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for your testimony. Ms. Moronis, did you have a presentation you wanted to make?
No,
just here for questions?
I was actually here just to provide a little bit of support. I've been more of a his guy Friday.
Great. Okay, good. Well, if there's nothing else, did you have anything else, Mr. Hobbs?
You want no. To add? No. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and best of luck.
Appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned.